Welcome to the Food and Faith Podcast, conversations from the soil and around the table with your co-hosts Anna Wolfenden and Sam Chamlin. Hello, Food and Faith Podcast. It is our joy and pleasure to have on the pod today, Jillian Hishaw. The three of us kind of connected over Wake Forest School of Divinity, but Jillian is just one of the most amazing movers and shakers in agriculture and in agricultural law. She is an agricultural attorney and an innovative strategist in the areas of agriculture, civil rights, and asset protection. She's also the founder of FARMS, which is a national nonprofit. FARMS stands for Family Agriculture Resource Management Services, and it exists to protect the family farmer from abuse through proper legal aging services while relieving hunger in the farmer's community. And so she is one of our foremost thinkers around agricultural law, thinking about it in the context of civil rights, being an advocate for farmers and their families and the land that they work. So, Jillian, it is our pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Wow, when you say it like that, I feel like Abraham Lincoln or something.
Well, from the first time I met you, Jillian, I knew that I needed to learn from you. And you're somebody that I wanted to just be in conversation with and pay attention to your insights. So we are thrilled to have you on the podcast. And we're really thrilled that our listeners are going to get to be in conversation with you as well and hear about the work that you're doing in areas for me that are so obvious once you say them, but that I had never thought like, oh, we should pay attention to that. So we're really grateful you took the time to join us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both. I should talk to y'all every day.
So we like to start off our podcasts with asking our guests about your geography. Where is the land and the food and the culture and the space that has shaped you and that is continuing to shape the work that you are doing? So we prepped you for this question.
Yes. So I'm originally from Kansas City, Missouri, and born and raised. And I do this work because my own family lost land in farmland in Oklahoma. And it was due to, the story is kind of vague, but it was either a shifty attorney or accountant. And because of that, that definitely motivated me in my law school and legal master's efforts to not be that shady attorney to farmers. And so after I finished law school at Arkansas and my legal master's in ag law at Arkansas in Fayetteville, I moved back home. And the first 4 years, I just focused on creating like environmental ag and slash food education programs for inner city youth in my old neighborhood. And I worked with small farmers in Kansas and Missouri and just teaching students about agriculture and science because my undergrad is in biology. And then from there, 5 years all the way up into the present, which is kind of my 12th year now, I've been focusing on legal work and policy, primarily with dealing with predatory abuses of aging farmers in the Southeast, and also primarily in the South. So we've expanded initially the first year, which I started FARMS in the fall of 2013. We just focused on the Carolinas. And then gradually over the years, we've expanded into Georgia, Arkansas, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas as of late. So that's kind of the realm of it all, but it's definitely continuing to gain momentum, specifically regarding our legal services and our food bank program.
Could you set the scene for me? I know that I've heard some of your stories, but maybe for our listeners, of what it looks like when you go out to a farm with some farmers who are aging, and what does that scene look like? What's their life? What are some of the life stories that you encounter, and what is it that you and your work does to change the trajectory of those lives?
Yeah, so there's definitely plenty of stories. I know that the 2017 USDA census is coming out in February of next year, but primarily the average age of the farmer is about 60 to 65, and that's across all demographics in the U.S. But the average age of the farmers that I work with are primarily 70, 75 and older. And so a lot of them are, of course, slowing down, and, you know, surprisingly, some of them are not. But a lot of them are slowing down because of a lot of the food safety certifications that are now required. As of January 2016, if you want to sell to any type of entity, you have to have a good agricultural practices certification or food safety certification. And that certification is an annual fee, and oftentimes that can range between $1,200 to $1,500 per crop. And so that's driving a lot of the small family farms that I work with out of business. And, you know, they're just primarily now selling at farmers markets and CSAs and things like that. And so when you go on the farm these days compared to when I started in 2013, a lot of them are growing less. A lot of them are slowing down more because they had hip surgery or knee surgery or, you know, whatever, because, you know, as we both know, farming is definitely hard labor. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're a small farmer and you can't afford a $250,000 combine. And so it's definitely hard, not only on the farmer's body, but also on their finances. And so a lot of them are being targeted by reverse mortgage companies. A lot of them are slowing down and, you know, qualifying for Medicaid. And so teaching them about Medicaid and the qualifications and how nursing homes can put a lien on the land and on the house is definitely something that's imperative. And now I primarily find myself doing a lot of elder care law out of anything, because I am dealing with an aging population.
So the abuse that you're talking about tends to be wrapped around issues around health and then also transfer of equity. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes.
Okay. And I know that you've written a book, which is now released for a second time. It's entitled Don't Bet the Farm on Medicaid. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that book is about and how it addresses some of these issues that you've committed your life to working on?
Yeah, so I'm in my master's is in ag law, so I'm definitely learning through the past recent years about Medicaid. But I just created a short booklet that's available on Amazon, but it's slowly becoming into a book. And the premise is to look at all 50 states and state exemptions, and basically looking to see if each state has protections for farmers against Medicaid liens. And so the second book includes 8 additional states. The first book that's available on Amazon includes 5 states, and those 5 states are Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, and Florida. And total, it's 13 states that I've looked at. And out of all of those states, Florida has the best protections for seniors, particularly when it comes to homestead protections. You can exempt up to, I think it's 120 acres in Florida. And there's also several other incentives that are definitely protective when it comes to farmers. Also Alabama, you can protect up to, it was either 20 or 40 acres. And in Georgia just updated their protections. And if you have an estate that's over 25,000, then basically it's exempt. And so, you know, these are things that definitely to consider and look at when you not only are an aging farmer, but when you have aging parents, because the nursing home has the federal authority to not only put a lien on the land, but on your home. So if you own a home and the value is upwards to $542,000 and you owe an outstanding debt, you can put a lien on the home. There are several state laws that if you have a parent that passed away in a nursing home and an outstanding debt was owed, then you as the daughter or the son are on the hook for that debt. And definitely has in Pennsylvania, precedence has been created. So, you know, these are things just to consider, you know, just in general.
That's helpful to understand. It makes me want to read your booklet and become better informed around that. I know that, so that's a big piece of what Farms does is the legal side of things, but I also know that you're addressing hunger in rural communities and working with food banks. And could you share a little bit about that side of your work and about Farms?
Sure. So Farms has primarily, we started out with three programs, but due to limited resources and, you know, the realization, hey, you can't do everything, we've whittled it down to two now. And so in addition to the legal services, we've always had our food bank program, and we purchase food from our farm clients, and then we donate to hunger relief entities in the farmers community. So half the time the farmer will select the donor entity, and the other times we'll find a location. And so over the past 5 years, we've donated over 260,000 pounds of fresh produce to various hunger relief agencies. So that it's called Farms to Food Bank, but it goes beyond the food bank. We've donated to food banks, of course, church pantries, homeless shelters, child and elder care centers, and about 80 to 85% in rural communities, and then about 15% in urban communities.
So I think sometimes we assume that because rural communities are producing food, that generally there are not issues around hunger there. And so what are some of the things that sort of drew your attention to rural hunger issues? What's your process from discovering where food is and getting it into the hands of the people who need it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the misconception. People think, hunger doesn't happen where the food grows, which is so not true, because most of the growth is basically, you know, exported out of the rural community. Mm-hmm. And it's exported in large masses. And even on, you know, small farms, they primarily sell it at farmers markets. And not all farmers markets accept EBT and SNAP. And so a lot of the produce that the farmers grow don't go to the people that essentially need it. And a lot of the people in the rural communities are living in high food insecure areas comparative to urban areas. In urban areas, they have more infrastructure, they have more resources, they have, you know, more food banks, YMCAs, and, you know, clubs and things like that. But in rural areas, you know, the economic loss is devastating. And so that's why most of our donations are focused on rural communities. And we always put the farmer first. And in putting the farmer first, you put their community first. And so just the lack of resources is just very overwhelming when I go into the communities. And it just pushes me more and motivates me more to buy more for the farmer and to donate more into those communities.
Is this an area where some of our listeners might be able to connect with you specifically? Obviously, I'm sure that Farms would welcome financial contributions, but it sounds like you're also working with farmers and with community agencies. If someone's listening and says, that's me, I want to help, where would you point them?
Yeah, I mean, definitely if you are a farmer and you're interested in growing for the program and selling to our program, there's a farmer sign-up sheet on our website, and you just click on the, I think it's the programs tab, and you'll see the farmer's sign up sheet, but unfortunately funds are definitely limited. And so because of that, we've definitely slowed down this year in our purchasing and donating efforts, because our grants haven't been as plentiful as in the past. So we're definitely looking also not only for more farmers to expand the program to other into other states, but also funders as well.
So, yeah, and that work is phenomenal. And so we encourage all of our listeners to go check out 30,000 Acres, to check out what they're doing and to donate. And certainly the issues around rural hunger are near and dear to my heart. And so thank you for doing that work and for paying attention to the people who are serving us. Now, I wanted to ask you sort of a 30,000 foot question. You've been part of this food and faith movement, and so much of this food and faith movement is about kind of thinking about what the future of agriculture and food and environment is going to be like. But I know that sometimes when I talk to actual farmers, they kind of smile and laugh at some of the idealism that can happen inside the movement. And so I'm wondering what, as you interact with legal issues and you act with the, you know, an aging agricultural population, what do you think the future of agriculture is? Like, where do you think we're at in 10 to 20 years based on where we're at legally and socially?
Well, I don't mean to be doom and gloom, but but it's just it's definitely becoming more monopolized, and the enforcement of antitrust is lacking, because the small farmer is getting squeezed out more and more. Over the past decade, over 140,000 farms have went out of business or consolidated. Now, you know, that statistic to me is scary. And the fact, comparing the 80s farmers crisis to now, you know, things are worse now than in the 80s. Oh, wow. You know, that definitely makes the hair on my neck stand up. And so it's just very cumbersome, because currently, I mean, just look at the trajectory overall and present. You know, currently four companies own 49% of the pork industry. Four companies own 56% of the poultry industry. And two companies own 60% of the seed industry globally. You know, that's not just the United States. And then two companies own 83% of corn, and 90 million acres of corn are, you know, planted in the U.S. And so these statistics definitely just tells you how things are moving. I think one glimmer of hope is that the public demands where their food is coming from. They demand labeling, food safety. I know that those demands have put a bit of a restraint on the small farmer when it comes to selling and the food safety certifications. But then there's also positives to that trend, because they're wanting, you know, more locally food, sustainably sourced food, you know, sold in their communities. They don't want, beef from, you know, outside countries imported and then labeled as U.S. imported. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those trends definitely bring hope to the current state, but definitely support the small farmer, whether it's livestock or specialty crop produce, because they definitely, you know, need our support.
Mm-hmm. And certainly supporting farmers markets, supporting small farmers is one thing. What else can communities of faith do? Because it was really around issues around communities of faith that brought all of us together, and wondering how small churches, new church plants, whatever, how can they be an advocate, not just for economically supporting farmers, but perhaps to even advocate for, you know, different ways of thinking about policy?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so it definitely starts on the local level, and then, you know, we can discuss up. But locally, I see churches basically having the farmer be a vendor. So if they're a member of the church, they'll have the farmer sell, you know, CSAs or sell on Sunday mornings, you know, their crops right there. And that's guaranteed income for the farmer. And they can sell each Sunday. Also, basically encouraging the members to sign up for subscription agreements with the farmer and things like that. And also supporting the farmer on a university level and saying, hey, we want to buy from small farmers. So if you're a faith-based educational institution, you know, allocating a certain percentage of purchase orders to small farmers will definitely help as well. Hmm. And in terms of the policy level, I mean, of course, that goes to all of the, you know, the national conventions on, you know, religious organizations. So whether it's the Baptist conventions, the Protestants, you know, Methodists, whatever, but having them advocate in DC is imperative for these farmers, because the farmers are usually, you know, connected to a church, and farmers are usually faith-based individuals. And so they know the value of the land. They know it better, you know, sometimes than the preacher that's, you know, preaching yeah. about, oh, the seed and, you know, soil and sacrament and things like that. And, you know, the fish and loaf story, but they know it. They know the soil. They know when it's good. They know when it's eroded and stripped of its nutrients. They know when they can't grow. And so who else to advocate for than the farmer, specifically, you know, within all of the conventions? And another thing is that we need to be holistic, because to me, oftentimes religion, it divides more than it brings together. And when it comes to the farmer, no matter what their spiritual belief, you should advocate for the farmer as a whole, not just in parts. So that's just my...
It's well said.
That's such a powerful statement. I'm interested. So I feel like I put myself, and I have been in this role of, in the role of like a church leader, pastors, involved, people are involved in a spiritual community. And I think that there's a lot of goodwill towards a more sustainable human, for the humans and for creation and way of being. But there's paralysis. I think people get overwhelmed really quickly in terms of, well, how can we, you know, even be part of that? And I really like the way you laid out so many specific ways that people could, that a community could engage these issues. I'm curious, if somebody came to you from a faith community and said, okay, we, you know, we're going to do three things this year, and acknowledging that we all need to do a lot more than three, but where did you point people to start as an entry point into this, these changes? Because they are so holistic. They are so all encompassing. And I feel like I'm looking to help people, and for myself to engage the work, is how do we get people started?
Well, yeah, I mean, just on the church level, it's, to me, it's fairly easy. I know during Christmas, you always find that a church will, you know, quote, adopt a family, and they'll buy presents and things for the family, or, you know, Thanksgiving turkey and things like this. But if a church is really committed, especially in a rural area, to their farming community, then they should adopt a family farm mm-hmm. you know, all year, and say, hey, you know, we're going to commit and we're going to adopt a farmer, you know, for a year. Okay. And we're going to, you know, basically have our members buy only from you and maybe another farmer. And that will definitely sustain that farmer, you know, throughout the year, because 48% of U.S. farmers, according to the 2012 USDA census, their annual farm revenue is $10,000 or less. Mm. I mean, farmers are not rolling in the dough here. And so no. I just think that people really need to wake up. I mean, I've definitely done my environmental advocacy during the years, but oftentimes people will say, like, for example, with a poultry farm, if something happens and, you know, the manure is, contaminates the soil or a local waterway, they'll automatically assume, oh, you know, all of the responsibility goes on the farmer. But, you know, that's not the case. I mean, you know, natural disasters happen and they don't realize that a lot of these farmers have to adhere to contracts with a lot of integrators and things like that. And so, you know, a lot of policy and logistics go into farming and educating churches about just the stress. I mean, the Guardian story that was released or published December of last year, it showed that the suicide rate for farmers exceed military veterans. Wow. And farmers are under a lot of stress. And, you know, on a daily basis, I find myself being more of a therapist than an attorney. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that people realize, particularly in urban areas, how stressed out these farmers are. And if a local church would adopt a farmer or two or three, and even if they wanted to do it in quarters, that would definitely make a positive impact on these farm families.
That's just such a powerful human and pastoral note. And I think we all need to listen to that, that this is a segment of our neighbors that are suffering in a particular way. And I love the idea of, you know, sponsor, adopt, cooperate with a farm. I mean, it's even better than just giving gifts because we all need to eat. So, you know, there's a reciprocity there that is, that's really powerful. I appreciate
that. And it's just a lot of, you know, as you all know, a lot of rural churches are going out and there's always, you know, someone with a divinity license or something. And I just feel like, you know, folks that are retiring from the church and things like that, they could be a therapist to, you know, their local farmer or something along those lines. I mean, there's so many different things that people can do.
Yeah. And again, just thank you for continuing to be an advocate for the farmer. One of the things that I love about you, though, is that you also are a bit of a visionary. And I'm reminded of a story that you and I had when we were out in California. We're riding around in a van. I don't know how the conversation got started, but you were like, you know what we need to be doing? And I'm like, what? She's like, we need to be growing hemp. And so you have been such a huge advocate for hemp production in the United States. And I wonder if you could just share a little bit about what the opportunities you see for hemp and if there are farmers or even communities of faith who want to practice some agriculture, like where might they go to begin to learn about hemp production and what that might look like for them?
Yeah, you know, actually this year has been kind of like my dive into it. And I definitely garnered a lot of information from the folks in the cannabis field that have been very also supportive of farms. And, you know, industrial hemp is like really amazing. And although it is connected to the cannabis species, it doesn't have the, you know, the THC level that cannabis does. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, over 34 states have passed state pilot projects for industrial hemp. And most of those state regs, which are very comparable to the Senate version of the farm bill that unfortunately didn't pass, if it's 0.30, then you can grow it and, you know, sell it. And, you know, you have to, I mean, you can't even get high off of smoking a whole football field of hemp. And so people, you know, think, oh, you know, you know, we're supporting, you know, drug culture and all this, but no, I mean, it's really amazing. And, you know, even, you know, going back to the spiritual or faith context, I mean, even Bible paper is made out of hemp. So, And then, you know, paper mills, I mean, they used to buy it up, you know, all the time. And this would go to the conservation piece that, you know, growing hemp, we can decrease the amount of deforestation. And so it's so many different assets, you know, to hemp. Even they have hemp concrete that's more durable in flooding and, you know, climate change impacts than the traditional concrete. And
go it, figure.
You know, it sustains more things. And so it's definitely a durable crop. And so encouraging more farmers to, you know, grow hemp instead of corn, which is, you know, the pricing of corn has been in the toilet for the past 5 years, is definitely a great option. And it's a great cash crop for farmers. And a lot of the farmers are seeing it, you know, as growing tobacco, basically. And it's thick and it'll rip up your tractor if you don't have the right attachment to it. But, you know, doing trial and error, you know, you can definitely get the hang. And Kentucky was, you know, the forerunner on this. And they've had their industrial hemp program going for, I think, over 5 years now. And so, you know, these are things to consider when we talk about helping the small farmer and the small family farm stay in business is hemp, and not monopolizing the field and making sure that certain licenses to grow are always allocated to small farmers and not just, you know, major corporate entities.
So that just might be a good segue as we wrap up. It seems like that there's hope in something like growing industrial hemp. There's hope in the intersection of faith communities with local farmers. And I think that there's hope in the policy work and the civil rights work around agriculture. And so we would just love to hear a little more from you about, am I right in assuming that these are areas you see hope? Are there other areas you see hope, and not some hope that's devoid of reality, but the hope of the plethora of actual solutions that can take us forward and can have a better quality of life for farmers, better for our planet, for our society as a whole? Where do you see hope?
Yeah, I definitely see it in the young people. Although we do have a youth component that has slowed down, I still take on interns, youth interns, like I was doing my first 4 years out of law school. And the students that I had in 2006 to 2009 and 10, you know, they come to me now, oh, Jill, I see what you were saying. And, you know, most of them were in Kansas City, but they have an appreciation of the farm. They have an appreciation of growing, you know, things in their, you know, apartment terrace or, you know, whatever, but they know where their food is coming from, especially the young men that were in my program that, you know, had to do the pig pen, which they didn't like.
That's memorable.
Yeah. And so, putting young people to work on a farm definitely, you know, puts hair on their chest, because I mostly had young men. But you know, when you're 16 and 15, you don't really, you know, realize it. But then, you know, now it's been, geez, that's been like 10, 12 years ago. And I go home and, you know, they see me or I see them and they're like, man, I'm working with youth now. You were so patient. you know, and we appreciate, you know, what you've done, and seeing young farmers as well, and working with younger farmers definitely, you know, brings glimmer, you know, to my eye or whatever. And even when I say young farmers, I mean, they could be in their 40s. I mean, because, you know, there's a 40-year difference from the farmers that I primarily have that are in their 80s and late 70s. And so, you know, definitely seeing young people that are committed to farming, whether it's urban or conventional and rural, definitely is hopeful.
Well, thank you for that. So if So how can people connect to your work? How can people support this work that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, there's always social media and the website. So please visit 30,000acres.org, and that's numbers, not words. And then we're also available on Twitter, on Farms 30,000, which we're more active on the Instagram than the Twitter. And Instagram, our handle is f.a.r.m.s. And also we have a Facebook page, but we're mostly active on the website and on Instagram. And then with me, I have a personal website as well, www.jillianhishaw, and that's HISHAW.com. And also I'm on Instagram and Twitter and all that type of stuff. But if you want to email me directly at info@30,000acres.org, that's also a good way to connect as well. So.
Fantastic. Well, we certainly encourage all of our listeners to check out 30,000acres.org and to make a donation. Being in rural areas, there's not, you know, Jillian is just one of the most important people we have working on rural farmer issues. And the organization you've got working there is just fantastic. So we just want to recap that.
Thanks. And also consulted with universities, University of South Carolina, Tuskegee University. Also the city of Charlotte. So consulting, speaking.
Jillian, every time I get a chance to chat with you, I walk away a little smarter. I walk away a little more aware, and I usually have a little bit of a laugh while doing it. So smoking a football field is certainly one of the things I'm going to laugh about for the rest of the day, but your inspirational work around supporting farmers, advocating for the least of these, sometimes the least of these that we forget are out there, has just been fantastic. So we just say thank you so much for coming on the pod, for sharing a little bit of your story, a little bit of your heart. And I imagine just as we continue to talk around rural realities and agriculture and law that you might be a regular guest just saying, hey, can you explain this to me? So so thank you so much for being a part of the pod today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Anna and Sam. I just love you both, as you know. If you didn't, I do.
We love you too. So. Yeah, we would love to have you as a regular. So listeners, get used to Jillian's voice. You're going to hear it again.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for having me again. And congrats again on starting the podcast. It's amazing.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Food and Faith Podcast. Our collaborators are Wake Forest University School of Divinity, Plainsong Farm, Garden Church, and the Keep and Till. And the music is by Paul Diemer. Follow along and keep up to date with the podcast on Facebook at Food and Faith Podcast, Twitter and Instagram at Food and Faith Pod, or on our website at foodandfaithpodcast.org.